Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Hiding in Plain Sight, How a Jewish Girl Survived Europe's Heart of Darkness, by Peter van Oos. Translated by David Doherty. Narrated by Suzanne Torin. Prologue. The Bug. Collect everything and sort it out after the war. Emanuel Ringelblum, historian. When she went out to feed the pigs once a day, the farmer's wife tossed the family's leftovers beside the trough. Through a small opening in the floor, the food reached five hungry people hiding below. Her husband had reckoned no one would go looking for Jews under a pigsty. He was right. Three of the five survived the war, though when liberation came, they bore little resemblance to the people who had knocked on the farmer's door 3 years earlier. A human being can barely exist on one meager ration of leftovers a day. Crouching for days on end takes a dreadful toll on the body. The two who did not live to see liberation had briefly left their hiding place in the hamlet of Godlevo-Vjelkje, to recover belongings they had hidden near their home. They probably hoped these goods would help them obtain more food from the farmer, or offer greater protection from the rats, the frost, the rainwater, or the stink and the filth of the pigs. They did not survive their expedition. The farmhouse is still standing, though today it serves as another farmer's shed, and decades of sun and rain have turned the wood a mousy gray. The new farmhouse is 15 meters away, the plaster on its outer walls crumbling to expose the shoddy workmanship of large building blocks poorly laid. The shed stands for a distant past, the farmhouse for a future that has already slipped away. Square and flat-roofed, the house looks like a miniature block of flats, with two floors and two identical balconies just big enough to hold a couple of bin bags. A satellite dish completes the picture. The Poles refer to these small farmhouses as kostka prolowskas, or little commie blocks, mini versions of the blocks of flats that sprang up in the big cities of the Polish People's Republic. Everyone calls them bloki. For 4 years, I lived in a city full of bloki, Warsaw, the capital of Poland. From there, I often traveled east, searching for people and places connected to a personal history that had captured my imagination. Most of these trips took me along the river Bug, spelled B-U-G, and as we drove, I would try to erase the square buildings from the landscape. One of the few certainties from the story I was chasing was its place in history. Before 1946, a time when farmhouses did not resemble little blocks of flats. And so, in a farmer's back garden some 100 kilometers from Warsaw, I concentrate on the wooden shed and picture it as it once was, a farmhouse at the time of the Second World War. With that image in mind, I go looking for the pigsty that must have stood beside or behind it. The Jews dug the pit beneath the pigsty, together with the farmer and his young son, in the summer of 1941, soon after German forces seized control of this part of Poland. The Jews, the farmer, and his son dug to a depth of almost 6 feet. It took them 2 days. I cannot find the place where the pigsty stood, and the Blocky Farm's present owner is not inclined to help. To him, my story sounds odd at best, and he drones on about never having met the owner from the 1940s. "I'm new around here," he says, which means he arrived in the 50s. A Polish friend has come with me to interpret. As we drive back to Warsaw, she asks me what the Polish Jews hiding at the farm have to do with the book I'm writing. I come up with a halting answer or two. One is that they came from Chijevo, 4 miles to the north. Now known as Chijevo Sada, the town used to be a shtetl, where my protagonist's mother and her parents once lived. Besides, I add, this is a story of Polish Jews who tried to survive the war in the Polish countryside, something my protagonist also tried to do for several months. My Polish friend smiles. "Go down that road," she says, "and you can travel forever." She does the maths. In Chijevo, 85% of the population was Jewish, which adds up to a few thousand individuals. Are all their attempts to survive relevant to my book? Her calculations don't stop there. In 1939, Poland was home to approximately 3.5 million Jewish citizens, at least 250,000 of whom sought refuge in the countryside. Do you need to know all their stories, too, to gauge the value of your protagonist's story? The protagonist she is referring to is a woman who lives in the Dutch town of Amstelveen, effectively a suburb of Amsterdam. She grew up in an Orthodox Jewish family in a Warsaw neighborhood that would go on to become the heart of the city's Jewish ghetto, in effect, a public prison established by the German occupier. She was the only member of her family to survive the war. Not by hiding under a pigsty, but by pretending to be somebody else, taking on different names and life stories at a time when your identity determined whether you lived or died. My Polish friend and I drive on in silence, and I feign a sudden interest in the dozens, if not hundreds, of billboards we pass along the way. Often they separate the road and a dry ditch from flat grassland with feeble rows of recently planted fir trees. There's a monotony to the world between Chijevo and Warsaw. My friend ventures a question. Do we still need to go to Wrocław to interview Czesław Cholewicki? Cholewicki is the son of the farmer who hid the Jews under his pigsty in Godlewo Wielkie. After the war, as a boy of 15, he moved west to a place that had once been in Germany but became Polish when the borders between the two countries were redrawn. Curiosity triumphs over common sense. Days later, we clock up a few more hours in the car and find ourselves side by side on a couch in the living room of a stone farmhouse near Wrocław. Cholewicki, a man of 88, tells us the tale as he remembers it, how he and his father dug a pit under the pigsty, covering it with two trees and a layer of mud and branches to make a new floor, how a kennel tacked onto the side provided a little fresh air, and how the Jews were allowed out for a short while at night to stretch their legs. His father had trained his dog not to react when it saw them, and luckily the farm was in a remote spot at the edge of the forest, so dogs on neighboring farms didn't bark at every sound or move they made. Cholewicki's account of the Jews' fate is short and to the point. A few days after the two had gone in search of their belongings, his father found their bodies in the forest, murdered, and probably not by the Germans. At the time, Germans were thin on the ground in those parts. Besides, the Jews had not been shot. The Germans were known for gunning people down, not going at them with clubs or pitchforks. The three Jews who remained in hiding stayed put until 2 days after liberation in the spring of 1944. Then they walked back to their looted homes in Chijevo, which, unlike the larger houses on the main square, had not been occupied by Catholic Poles. News of their return spread like wildfire. A group of armed Poles paid them a visit, looking for money, gold, anything of value. People thought any Jew who had survived the whole ordeal must be very rich, said Cholewicki. But those people had nothing. The armed Poles killed the father, mother, and daughter, who had lived for 3 years in the pit beneath the pigs. Then they set out for the farm in Godlewowielkie. The Cholewitzki's dog announced their arrival. Young Czesław ran out the back door and took cover in the bushes. From his hiding place, he heard the Poles screaming at his father. "Where is the Jew's gold? Where have you hidden it?" The men found nothing. "They beat my father so badly he could no longer stand." Within days, he died of his injuries. My Polish friend is right. This is a detour, one of many. Even so, I believe it to be worthwhile, not only because its dispiriting brutality is typical of the detours anyone traveling back in time east of Berlin might make, but also because talking to Czesław Cholewitzki made me realize for the first time that I had been chasing an illusion. I had spent too long trying to unsee all kinds of things. The blocky farmhouses, the billboards, the restaurants built to look like castles, the hundreds of roundabouts named after Pope John Paul II, the mint green favored by the residents of rural Poland when painting their plastered houses. By blotting them out, I had hoped to return to a time before 1946 to describe more vividly the world in which my protagonist lived. But after yet another tale of woe, I understood that I had been searching, obsessively perhaps, for a place that had probably never existed. A fairy tale world of colorful settlements set among green hills and leafy landscapes, where birds sang, streams burbled, and wheat swayed in the fields, where life was not only pure and simple, but alive with a rich sense of community. Cholewitzki's story was a final shove in the right direction. Despite the things I wanted to believe in, it had gradually begun to dawn on me that even without the blocks, billboards, and rain-swept roundabouts, my idealized world was not about to materialize. I understood that 80 years ago, this place was every bit as flat, wet, grim, and cold. That its people, like people everywhere, were capable of terrifying ruthlessness, and that poverty was ugly and appalling. There was a good reason why, before the war, the little town of Czyżewo had been home to people smugglers. Two men who, for a substantial sum, could arrange emigration to America, Canada, or Argentina, or, at a pinch, to Germany or Czechoslovakia. Czyżewo's people smugglers lived alongside three egg sellers, an assortment of roofers, masons, peddlers, butchers, and bakers, a watchmaker, two carpenters, a hat maker, a blacksmith, and dozens of Luftmenschen, literally air people, or what we would call dreamers, residents who had to rely on charity. A report from 1939 reveals that organized assistance was the only source of income for 1 in 5 Polish Jews. Journalist Raphael F. Scharf survived the war. In 1939, he was living and working in London as a correspondent for a Polish newspaper. He devoted his later years almost entirely to spreading the word about the Jewish world in which he'd grown up. In countless lectures, he stressed the importance of steering a clear course between nostalgia and reality. "Yes," he wrote, "over 3 million Jews had lived in pre-war Poland and had formed the most vital, life-enhancing branch of Jewish life in the diaspora. They were a spring from which there flowed a contribution to the literary, musical, and scientific legacy of mankind, in disciplines as varied as Talmud studies and modern science." Yet, at the same time, he argued, the crime committed by the Germans was so immense that it is impossible to increase the scale of its inhumanity by idealizing the past. Idealization can only stand in the way of the historical reality. This insight informed my interviews with the protagonist of this book, Mala Rivka Kizil, whose survival story became my guide through the history of Central Europe in the 20th century. Today she lives as Marilka Schlafer, just outside the Dutch capital. She was born in Warsaw, the sixth in a family of eight children, in February 1926. In the chapters that follow, she is Mala. To me, she is Mrs. Schlafer. I visited her on several occasions at her charming yellow brick home, tucked away in a small neighborhood of terraced houses between the Bosbaan rowing lake and the river Amstel. In her light and airy living room with its round table, she welcomed me with coffee and biscuits. Her walls were hung with framed photographs, recent snapshots of her children and grandchildren, and of herself with friends from the local bridge club. One featured a bright-eyed Mrs. Schlafer holding a silver trophy as beaming club members bunched in around her. Mala is the daughter of Esther Doba Saper and Sender Yitzchok Kizil. The colors and brushstrokes in which she paints her childhood are a long way from Marc Chagall's dreamlike visions of Jewish shtetl residents hovering above colorful wooden houses in the company of mythical, sometimes smiling creatures, the occasional fiddle tucked under one arm. Mala loved her parents. She grieved for them, and grieves to this day, almost 80 years after their lives were taken. Yet she has no qualms about telling me that, because she was a girl, her parents paid her little attention. "You were better off as a boy," she says. The children were never allowed too close to their mother, who suffered from an infectious illness, probably tuberculosis. And, health permitting, mother was busy working in the toy shop she ran. "I didn't see much of her," Mala says. "I only remember one kiss on my leg when she was tying my shoelace." Her father devoted his life to studying the Torah and teaching young Talmud scholars, boys only, of course. "My father believed you shouldn't so much as look at a girl, not even your sister. He impressed this on my brothers, who of course were expected to live by the tenets of their faith. The birth of a boy was cause for elaborate celebration, complete with presents and sweets. Girls came into the world in silence. Father never showed me any real affection, not so much as a pat on the head." Mala is a short woman, neither slim nor plump. Perhaps robust is the best description. White waves of well-kept hair frame her sharp features and keen eyes. Recalling events that expose the deepest abysses of human nature, she speaks with remarkable lightness, a tone I have never really encountered in writings or discussions about the Holocaust. She smiles frequently, and rarely from a sense of awkwardness, yet she trivializes nothing. Her story traverses the abyss. Today's editorials on what we now call identity politics pale by comparison, or at least take on a different hue. Even so, the comparison is worth making. Mala's story is driven by humanity's obsession with nation, state, race, and identity. Before I met Mala, I had already heard an abridged version of her story, told to me by her grandson, Amir Svab, a friend I had lost touch with until the day I turned up at a venue in Warsaw to find him sitting at the piano. A pianist by profession, he was the accompanist to a one-woman show designed to delight Dutch expats with songs that poked fun at the bourgeoisie back home. Amir is a man with unruly curls and fine features, regularly lit up by a roguish smile, suggesting a lightness of heart not easy to rhyme with his contemplative nature. After the show, he told me he had been to Warsaw before. His great-grandmother lay buried in the Jewish cemetery, and he had once gone looking for her grave. We agreed to pay her a visit the next day. Warsaw's vast Jewish cemetery is one of the few physical remnants of the city's Jewish community. We found the headstone we were looking for, and Amir, who had lived in Israel for a time, read the Hebrew inscription. His great-grandmother had died in 1934, when her daughter, Amir's grandmother Mala, was just a girl. Sitting in the sunshine that day, Amir told me how that girl had survived the war. It is a story that has stayed with me ever since. In the months and years that followed, I was seldom able to give a clear account of Mala's life. I would lose myself in the details that seemed to give so much value to a story as improbable as it is true. Those details show survival to be an intense version of growing up, one that draws on all the chameleon-like qualities that resilient teenagers develop along the way, and that can become a matter of life or death when you are compelled to live outside your own group. Mala grew up in a world dominated by people who, however stark their differences, shared a belief in the evil of entire communities, in traits prescribed by ethnicity that could be ranked according to a hierarchy of origin, nationality, and race. After my day with Amir in Warsaw, I visited Mala at home a number of times, and she told me her life story. By then, she had committed this story to paper in a memoir entitled How I Survived the War. I transcribed our recorded conversations, and then, with the transcripts and her memoir to hand, I set out on a journey through time, tracking down the cities, towns, and villages, the people and the buildings that figure in her story, looking for documents, books, and eyewitness accounts to provide more context. This journey raised new questions at every turn, and I put these to Mala on subsequent visits. Email proved useful, too. Mala is a computer-savvy woman in her 90s who answers promptly. More often than not, her answers turned out to be repetitions, echoes of memories she had already shared. Eventually, it dawned on me that her mind was not a reservoir of missing details I could simply tap into. In time, I learned not to bother her as much. I would have to make do with what she had already told me and written down, bolstered by what I could discover through archives, books, and conversations. Poland had another lesson in store. People can simply vanish from the course of history. This happens elsewhere, too, but in Poland, Belarus, and Ukraine especially, entire families, villages, and communities have been carried off on the current of time. When writing his History of Central and Eastern Europe around the time of the Second World War, historian Timothy Snyder chose to call it Bloodlands, a place where soldiers and civilians died in their millions, either murdered or wiped out by hunger, disease, and exhaustion. 1/6 of Polish citizens alive and well in 1939 did not survive the violence of the 8 years that followed. As a percentage, it is the greatest loss of life in any country as a result of the Second World War. Hundreds of thousands, if not millions more, fled the country or were deported. Ethnic consolidation took place on a scale never before witnessed. The ruins and mass graves in the region between Berlin, Minsk, and Kiev formed a blank slate on which totalitarian leaders sought to construct a new, unsullied vision of the future. It was against this background that I set out to piece together a world that once was. Mala's school is a case in point. The finest in Poland, she called it. She even remembered the name of the street where it was located. A simple enough fact to check, you might think. Yet, even armed with this information, it took weeks and consultations with several experts to track it down. or more accurately, until I first laid eyes on proof that the school existed. 75 years on, not a single stone remained of the building itself. Another example, in an area that is now part of Ukraine, but belonged to Poland until 1939, I went looking for a church where Mala had asked the parish priest for a baptismal certificate. "You don't want to be baptized," he told her. "You want to stay alive." And he gave Mala the certificate of a Polish country girl whose name she remembers to this day. This turned out to be no help. The region's church records had been destroyed in the ensuing violence and political upheaval. Letters to the Archdiocese of Lviv, a visit to an abbey near the church, an appointment with the ecclesiastical archives in Warsaw, nothing brought me closer to the priest who had helped Mala. Chastened, but not discouraged, I kept plugging away, probably spurred on by that old maxim from my training as a journalist, a single source is as good as none. I continued my travels, hungry for present-day confirmation of this story from a distant past. Thankfully, there were other sources closer to home, not least the Jewish Historical Institute in Warsaw. Before long, this became the epicenter of my exploration of Mala's past. It is an institute with a remarkable history, founded on the discovery of 2 milk cans and a few tin boxes buried beneath the rubble of what had once been Warsaw's Jewish ghetto. In the spring of 1943, historian Emanuel Ringelblum hid this unlikely archive under the cellars of several houses. At that point, Ringelblum knew the total destruction of the ghetto was imminent, having been told that its last surviving inhabitants planned to launch a desperate attack with whatever weapons they could lay their hands on, the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. The milk cans and boxes contained descriptions, documents, and statistics that Ringelblum and his staff had written, collected, and compiled since the earliest days of the ghetto. Their aim was to record as much information as possible about the last gasp of the Jewish community in Poland, and Warsaw in particular. Ringelblum's team consisted of between 50 and 60 historians, writers, journalists, and a handful of untrained volunteers. They collected German propaganda posters, children's drawings, ration coupons, writs, concert announcements, diary excerpts, and even sweet wrappers and tram tickets. They got medical professionals to draw up reports on the effects of hunger in the ghettos. They wrote their own accounts of the community's decline in all its facets. And they even managed to obtain information about the workings of the extermination camps in Treblinka and Chełmno. All so that future historians would not have to rely solely on the records of perpetrators, collaborators, and those who stood by and did nothing. This enormously labor-intensive undertaking, and the diversity of the material, was driven by Ringelblum's view of history. As a historian with a background in social work and journalism, he was keenly aware of how every chronicler colors and reshapes events by describing them. To ensure objectivity, to achieve as accurate and comprehensive a picture as possible of the war events in Jewish life, he wrote, we tried to have the same incident described by as many people as possible. By comparing various accounts, the historian is able to arrive at the historical truth, the actual course of the event. 3 of Ringelblum's team survived the war, one of whom helped search for the makeshift archive beneath the rubble of what had been the ghetto. The first milk cans were unearthed in September 1946, followed a few years later by a second cache of boxes. A third milk can remains lost to this day. Through the years, the Institute, which went on to bear Ringelblum's name, has added to the 35,000 pages from the recovered cans and boxes, bringing together yet more pre-war documents that survived the devastation. Marriage certificates, birth certificates, Yiddish newspapers.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?